Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Psychology Games podcast. As you may have heard from your high school guidance counselor back in the day, my name is Jamie Madigan, and I'm your host. My mission is to dive into the psychology literature and come back with things to help you understand why video games are so often designed the way they are, why they are marketed and sold as they are, and why gamers behave as we do when we play them. Now, normally I do this on the podcast with the help of a guest expert. That's the formula. But as I post this, I am in Seattle for PAX West, where I'm going to be part of a couple of cool panels about psychology and video games with some other great people. By the way, it's possible that one or both of those panels will be recorded and available for viewing at some point. I'll make sure to let you know when that happens. But I've been busy prepping for these PAX panels, and I haven't quite had time to assemble a proper podcast. I actually do have one recorded that I'm still working on, and another one scheduled to record shortly after I come back from PAX, but nothing is ready right at this moment. So instead of missing an episode or being late, I'm going to share a talk that I did a couple of years ago, in which I have only shared with my Patreon supporters up until now. They had it exclusively for almost 2 years, and actually the video version I made for them is actually still exclusive to Patreon supporters. But for everybody, I hope you enjoy this audio presentation of the material. What I have for you today is an extended version of a talk that I did for Kai Play in 2016, which is a conference about computer and human interaction, specifically in the realms of play or games. And the talk is one of the keynote speeches that I was invited out to give. It's called Things I Wish Game Researchers Would Do More, or at least do more of, a view from an occasional scientist and hardcore gamer. That's me. So I'll skip over the part where I talk about me and psychologyofgames.com and the website and the podcast and all that sort of stuff and the book, because you guys probably know about it already. But I'm in a great position here today when I'm doing this talk, in that I don't make games and I don't conduct research on games, because both of those things are very difficult. What I do instead is I write about the intersection between those two topics, and I get to sit here and be the idea guy today. And looking back on the academic research about video games, it's amazing how much of it has expanded since I started doing this project, this psychology of games thing, back in about 2009. And there was a lot of research that existed beforehand as well, and I familiarized myself and learned all about that. But science has advanced in this area, and critically, it's being put to use by people in the games industry. One analysis that I saw showed a 274% increase in peer-reviewed publications about, you know, video games in psychology journals in 2010 to present, relative to the early 2000s. And there are some big picture items, though, that tend to get a lot of the attention. So these are things like violence in video games, educational uses of games, gaming addiction or problematic gameplay, gamification's a whole giant topic in and of itself, use of games for physical health and mental health, and a handful of other types of topics. And these are important and worthwhile subjects of study, and they totally should continue. But often left out of the body of research and understudied are sort of medium to little picture topics that players, community managers, and game developers can put directly to use. So these are things that people can do or experiment with in order to create the kinds of games and gaming experiences that they're looking for. Things that people like me then could point to when some member of the press calls and says, why is this game so popular? Why do people like to play games? Or whatever hot question or hot game that they're trying to write a story about. And in the course of reading, writing, podcasting, lecturing, and talking to people about the psychology of the video games over the last 7 years, I have noticed some stuff that gamers and game designers want to know about. So I think I have a broad exposure to a lot of different ideas and questions that people who play, make, and sell games want to know about. And I interact with them on the website and in social media, at conferences and other venues. And so I kind of get to hear a lot about it. So in a way, maybe you can think of this as a man or woman on the street piece about the psychology of games and the issues that people are interested in. And it's probably worth noting that the process that I go through to generate ideas for the blog and for the podcast can probably best be described as flailing and spastic. What I mean is that I throw a wide net to all the different corners of psychology and all the different areas of psychology. So I'll research social psychology, industrial organizational psychology, judgment decision making, consumer psychology, cognitive psychology, positive psychology, cyber psychology, personality psychology, and a lot of other different things. This means that I have noticed a lot of theories, models, measures, concepts that are applied to non-gaming contexts, and then I try to push and poke at them until they seem that they could apply to psychology of games. That's kind of my MO for the blog. What that means is that throughout this talk, I'll be mentioning all these other different types of theories and how those could be fruitful starting points for anybody wishing to research this stuff further. So what I have are 30 ideas spread across 9 topics. The benefits of gaming to the player, in-game purchases, motivation to play, psychology of game mechanics or systems, social contexts, biases and decision-making heuristics in games and game design, competition, states of mind that players get into, and what I call the dark side of psychology in games. The first topic is the benefits of gaming. These are the things that could be done for the benefit of the player. And there's actually been a lot of research on things like exergaming and use of games to promote healthy habits or healthy eating and that type of stuff. And Jane McGonigal has famously applied positive psychology to video games in her books. But there are a few other more specific things I'd like to go through. And the first question is, how can games be used for stress recovery? Some research on how leisure activities are used to recover mental resources and cope with stress would be interesting and insightful here. So there's a whole body of research that says that in order to recover from stressful events at work or school, you know, we like to engage in leisure activities that give us, one, a sense of psychological detachment, like they literally focus our attention somewhere else. Two, offer us relaxation. Three, offer us a mastery experience, that is, feeling like we're getting better at something or progressing in some difficulty curve. And what's unique about video games is that they let us do all of these things. Video games seem like they are custom made for stress recovery activities in this way. Games require focus of attention. They require you to literally take your mind off whatever was stressing you out and focus on the game. Anecdotal evidence, a lot of it suggests that games are relaxing. When asked why people like to play games, they say it just helps me unwind. It helps me relax. And good game design, one of the hallmarks is that it offers you a level of mastery experience, like lets you feel that you're good at something or getting good or progressing and becoming better. So games seem to be custom made for stress recovery. And I think another interesting related question here is, can microgaming, the types of short, small gaming experiences we might have on a phone or a web game, can short bursts of that throughout the day help mitigate stress on the job? Second question, what are the functions of in-game relationships? So this is around the idea that do the friends that we make in games provide social support like online friends or like offline friends? Do any of the relationships that we form in games? And there's been some recent research on online relationships to kind of show that, you know, the types of relationships we might encounter in a message board or through chat or through Skype or any of these types of internet-mediated relationships, that they can displace relationships that we have face-to-face, and that people will do that, that people might try to compensate for lack of ability or lack of opportunity to form face-to-face relationships by forming online ones, or there might be some combination of the two. So the question of, do relationships developed through online games displace other relationships? What about games facilitate these kinds of relationships? And do they do any good, or are they as good as face-to-face relationships or other online relationships? And then I think relatedly, and a really interesting question would be like, what kinds of tools and resources foster these sorts of relationships, and what can game developers and community managers do? Like, what could they provide their player base in terms of tools and resources and information and meeting places and structured social activities that would help people form these sorts of beneficial relationships? Lots to borrow from the communication and the social psychology literature here. Next question is, can games help you develop emotional skills? I actually get this question a lot. Can game experiences help you develop emotional abilities, specifically like empathy? Empathy for a character or somebody who's different from you. Can they broaden one's worldview and combat things like prejudice or inclinations to stereotype people? There's probably some clinical psychologists who can speak to this better than I can and more, but I think it would be a really interesting field of inquiry. Next topic, let's talk about in-game purchases and the psychology thereof. This is like a whole topic that I could probably do an entire lecture on. Maybe I should sometimes. It's kind of a pet interest of mine. And I think there's a lot of things we could still learn by applying psychology to these questions. And we can just kind of start right off the bat with the question of what triggers in-game purchases. I feel like we know a lot about this topic outside of video games, but there doesn't seem to be much studied in the context of games, especially mobile games, that's publicly and widely shared. My understanding is that a lot of people working in the gaming industry have studied the heck out of this, and they know all sorts of trigger and conversion points and sort of how to structure those experiences, and that it may get talked about sometimes in game development communities and at conferences, like, but it's behind closed doors a lot of time, and they don't publish or share publicly that information as much. I think it's a great opportunity for somebody with a more scientific bent that wants to study this and share it for the benefit of everybody. So, for example, there's this concept of ego depletion or willpower, which is in literature right now, and it's under a little bit of scrutiny, kind of some people questioning it's really as legitimate or as widespread as it seems. But there are a lot of research that shows that we have sort of this mental reservoir of willpower and mental resources that we draw upon to do difficult mental things like resist temptation, make difficult decisions, calculate things, think about things deeply, and so forth. And when that pool of mental resources is depleted, that we are more susceptible to certain biases in decision making, that we may just kind of go with the default options, for example, or we may be more susceptible to framing effects, that type of thing. And so that leads to the question of, in game purchases, if you time the pitch correctly after a player has done something mentally taxing, would that lead to more uptake on those mental or on those purchasing options? Virtual currency, I think, is a big topic of study, potential study. Does the transparency effect and monopoly money happen more with virtual currency? For example, there's plenty of research from consumer psychology showing that people spend less with cash and more with credit cards and in-store credit, because cash is the most transparent form of payment that we can make. And we see very clearly the trade-off and the relationship between what we're giving up, you know, the pain of losing that money, and the pleasure of getting the thing back that we're purchasing. But when you start to talk about payment options that are temporally disconnected from that moment when we're getting something, things like using a credit card or store credit, writing a check, a lot of research shows that we then assign those pains and pleasures to different events in our lives, and we treat things differently, and we spend more money the less transparent the method is. And I think that in-game purchases with virtual currencies like purple diamonds or gold coins or whatever are not transparent at all, and that there's probably a lot of psychology going on there to show that the way that we use that virtual currency, that, you know, we buy them in bunches of 100 purple diamonds for $10 or whatever, that we start to do things with mental accounting, and we feel like those purple diamonds are now free to spend, and they don't really have the same value that they would have if we were paying cash for something. So there are different mental accounting effects going on. And, you know, do we spend more money because it feels wasteful to leave leftovers? So if we upgrade our barracks and that costs 7 purple diamonds and we had bought a pack of 10, so we have 3 left over, do we treat those 3 differently than we would if we had bought them separately as a separate transaction? Lots of really interesting stuff that could be studied here and would elucidate either how to make more effective microtransaction systems or help players approach them more on their own terms. Next question is, what do we think of people who pay to win? So there was a really interesting study a while back. I wrote about it on the website about how buying in-game advantages can damage one's social status and reputation within a game. And the researchers they brought volunteers in and they looked at 3 different games. It was Diablo 3, World of Tanks, and MapleStory, which are all online multiplayer games where you can buy advantages either in the form of equipment or boosts or consumables that would give you an advantage relative to other players, even if it's a cooperative setting where, you know, you would pay real money and you would have better equipment or whatever than the other players. And so they brought these people in and asked them to imagine these different scenarios where people were paying to win in this way, and asked them all sorts of questions about what they thought. And they found that they wouldn't want to pair up with that person or group up with that person as much. They would enjoy seeing that person fail. They would not stop to render aid to that person or resurrect them, you know, in the game. And they would not accept friends requests and those types of things. They wouldn't respect them. and they would enjoy seeing them killed in the game specifically. So it's really interesting, but it was only like a hypothetical situation where they asked them to imagine these different scenarios and then asked them what they would do or what they would think. It would be really interesting for research to look at these pay to win options and see what real effects that has on people's, whether or not they accept a friend request, whether or not they accept a group request, whether or not they would spend money on items themselves to try to close the gap between themselves and that person. Really interesting potential research to be done here and have a lot of implications for how these systems are designed. Next topic is gaming motivation. So this actually is a well-studied concept in the psychology of video games. And why do people play games is a pretty common question. And it's a pretty important question. And it's one that I get a lot. Member of the press will just call up and say, like, why do people play these things? Why will people grind? Why will they do these? You know, why do they enjoy playing video games? And there's still, though, a lot of practical research on this question that goes beyond just sort of gaming types and what types of games do people like to play. For example, question number 6, do game elements motivate by setting goals? I think there's a whole class of gaming systems and elements that are almost ubiquitous in games. You have side quests and quest logs. You have upgrade systems and trees, talent trees. You have achievements. You have even just progress bars that fill up and progress indicators that fill up. There seems to be with all these things like an assumption that they work and that they're there because they motivate players through some sort of goal setting mechanism. So if you set the goal of complete this quest or fill up this progress bar or reach this achievement or upgrade your sword all the way, the idea is that setting a goal motivates players to focus on that and keep playing the game and stay engaged with the game for longer than they otherwise would. And indeed, there's an entire literature on goal setting and motivation out there in other contexts, usually work or personal improvement. And you see, for example, in consumer psychology, how well frequent buyer cards work, you know, where you have to buy products and then you get punches on your card and the 10th one is free or whatever, or you earn rewards like discounts and coupons and that kind of thing. There's research to show that those things work. There's this concept in psychology called psychological reactance, that we hate losing choices once we feel that we have them. Quest logs and goals in games work that same way, is that, well, yeah, once this thing is on my quest log, I don't want to fail that quest. I don't want it to go away or have the option of it going away. But I think video games create different use cases than a lot of these other scenarios. We have the effects of competing goals in games a lot of times, where the game is structured in such that we have to choose between different goals. And we have the effects of narrative on reactants and goals. Like, we may choose one goal over another because we like a particular NPC or we like a particular narrative path that we want to see the game go down. And then, you know, there's just the entire idea that these types of things like reactants may be undone by the simple fact that we can quick save and quick load and we can replay a game. And that, like, what effect does that have on motivation via goal setting? Then we often have layered and multiple progress indicators. Most games will have not just one progress bar, but they'll have multiple things that you're working towards at any time. You're not just grinding for reputation with one faction. You've got multiple ones that may go up and down. And so what does that do? And what are the limits on how motivated we will be with all these different progress indicators? And what decides which ones we will focus on? Some really interesting questions that could be better answered. Another question is, why are loot drops so motivating in games? So this is kind of getting down to your plus five brass tacks, but there's a lot of assumptions about random loot in games. I've written about this a lot. But do we know for sure that random rewards in games are most motivating? Has any research actually been done on this? Considering, what about game systems that let you break down or disenchant items into materials that you can then use to craft, like greater and better stuff? Like, what does that have to do, and how does that interact with random loot drops? And which ones are more motivating and which ones will keep us playing when a disenchantment system is in place? There's probably a lot to learn from the gambling psychology literature and even the educational psychology literature on this type of thing. But I feel that we've got a solid assumption here, but that we haven't quite filled in all the corners. Number 8, why do people love really difficult games so much? This is another question I get all the time. What motivates people to keep trying over and over and over and over and over again when they fail? Like, these really, they're called like massacre games sometimes. Like, Spelunky and the Mega Man games, and Dark Souls is a great example of this, where they're really difficult or otherwise punishing games that people nonetheless will keep attempting over and over and over again and failing at and sort of never get discouraged and want to keep trying until through some combination of luck and skill, they finally get through and then they go on to the next challenge. There's a lot of really interesting research by Carol Dweck about the psychology of mindsets, where she talks about a fixed versus a growth mindset, where a fixed mindset is where you think like my ability in this area is fixed or determined by some qualities of me, my genetics or my situation or whatever. And that's it. That's as good as I can do. And I shouldn't try to do any better, versus a growth mindset where you say like my potential is practically unlimited and I may be terrible at this now, but I know that if I continue practicing and learning and trying and getting feedback and adjusting what I do, then I could grow and eventually get through, and that you will get better through practice, effort, and time. And do people of certain mindsets react differently to these massacre games? I think there's a lot that we could learn about learned helplessness. Martin Seligman's experiments on dogs, where he shocked their poor little paws and taught them learned helplessness, that, you know, there was nothing they could do to better their situation. They were just going to have to curl up and accept it, versus teaching dogs, other dogs, that, you know, they could hop over a barrier and they were, you know, better off in the future. And then that research then evolved into different attributions that people make for failure, whether they're internal or external and stable or unstable and global and specific. And certain combinations of these attributions for one's failure lead to better outcomes in terms of like mental health and whether or not you continue persisting and trying to do a task and how good you feel about yourself and how happy you are. So what in games determines if somebody will give up on a challenge versus bracing for it and tackling it? And how does it interact with these different mindsets and these different attributions for failure? Can we do something with game systems and the way that we feedback information to players about their performance that makes it more likely that they'll adopt a growth mindset or a more beneficial pattern of attributions for failure? Framing of challenges and expectations, like what there can we set up and what there can we do to help set players up for success? How can we use social information and information about other players and what they've done to encourage players to persist and so forth? Number 9, how do we link game mechanics with gamer motivators or types? So there's been a lot of research going back quite a few years about these different player types, and started with Bartle's, you know, explorer, achiever, those types of different classes of people and what motivates them and what interests them. And then that research developed, other researchers took it and sort of applied some more scientific and quantitative data to it and found other types of motivators, like, okay, these are your different types of players and these are the types of gaming experiences that they react to. And one of my favorite, Quantic Foundry, has one of the most data-driven ones that I've seen so far. And I've written on the website and interviewed one of the guys there on my podcast before, so you can go look it up. But sort of consistently, what a lot of these systems do is they always want to link motivators back to genres of games. So they'll say, this category of person, this category of players enjoys role-playing games or strategy games or action games. But I think that genres is a busted concept and it's not really useful anymore in broader conversations. It's been a while since Deus Ex first added RPG elements to first-person shooters, and it seems like every new game that comes out nowadays has some blend of genres and don't fit neatly into those categories anymore. And genre is not really a useful concept for talking about games. And I think we need to move beyond genres into mechanics, systems, gameplay elements, these types of experiences. Is the game motivating for me because, not because it's a role-playing game, but because of the upgrade system or the customization system or the competitive layer to the game? Those types of things, you know, those types of mechanics and systems. We need researchers to sort of take on this new paradigm when talking about gamer motivation. All right, it's time for the lightning round about game mechanics and systems. See, because it's lightning from Final Fantasy. All right, so how is identity or other information signaled through showing off? And there's this whole concept called signaling theory in psychology, where we use things that we do or things about ourselves to signal information to others. And there are things in video games that allow us to do this, you know, avatars and profiles and loadouts and that type of stuff. So what are the mechanics by which that happens? How can game developers provide tools that allow players to do that the way that they want to. Number 11, does deliberate practice make you better at games? So there's this whole concept recently by Anders Ericsson about deliberate practice and how you get to be an expert at something. And it's the whole 10,000 hours of practice concept that Malcolm Gladwell made popular, though it turns out that that number is not really that important. It's more about a large amount of very deliberate practice and done in a very specific way. And when this age of professional game players, not only like streamers and YouTubers, but also esports competitors, is there something that they can learn from this concept of deliberate practice? Number 12, why do players grind? Like, why do players do the same thing over and over and over again in the hopes of getting some random reward for it or in the hopes of making incremental progress towards some distant goal? It's a question that I get a lot. Why do players do it? Number 13, does forcing players to take breaks do them or anyone any good? So there's this concept in psychology called hedonistic treadmill. The idea is that we get used to pleasure and pain the more we experience it. So something that seems pleasurable or painful, that if it persists for a long time becomes less so, we sort of get used to it, right? But the idea is that research has also shown that even taking short breaks from those experiences will sort of reset them to their default value, and we won't be used to them anymore after that short break. A lot of games these days are designed to be played in short bursts or will require you to take breaks between play sessions. Does doing that affect how much people enjoy playing those games? Do they enjoy playing a game overall, you know, if they play it in 5 short sessions versus 1 marathon session that's 5 times as long? Number 14, what effects do tutorials, instructions, and overbearing help have on how people play games? The idea here is going to some of the research on psychology and creativity and innovation, where showing that if you take a person and you show them exactly how a product or a system works, and you give them exhaustive information about that, it very much limits the possibility space that they see when they start doing it, and you lose out on a lot of emergent and creative interactions with those types of things. And I see this in video games show up with tutorials that last for 3 or 4 hours versus sandbox type games that just sort of dump you in a world. Like the early days of Minecraft were a great example of this, where you just got plopped into the world and were told to figure it out on your own. And that led to a lot of really interesting, emergent, fun, creative types of things. So is there a way that we can seize on that to create the type of gaming experience that we want? All right, the next topic is social context and the social nature of games. Games are played most often with other people, and even single-player games have these days a layer of social interaction built into them, whether it's leaderboards or comparing gear and accomplishments and achievements and so forth. There's always something social about games. So question number 15 is, how do leaders in massively multiplayer online games influence their guildies, their guildmates? And in the industrial or organizational or work psychology science, there's this idea of studying leadership, like studying what is it about people that make them effective leaders. And one of the more popular models of leadership is called transformational leadership. And this is where managers and other leaders in an organization sort of create a vision for their group, and then they help members of that group figure out how they need to change or transform in order to achieve that vision. So like, what is it that you need to do and how is it you need to change what you do and how you think about the work that you do in order for the group to reach that objective? And a lot of the things that come out of this are, you know, engagement with your work and creating a sense of identity and pride around your work and a sense of ownership and responsibility in the work that you do and in your part in the organization, part of the team. I think this begs the question of why or how do leaders in MMOs or other gaming groups influence their guildmates? And often, you know, much relies on somebody to sort of shape the culture of that group, to clarify roles, to motivate other players to play the game, to show up, to prepare for the raid, to, you know, grind out your consumables and come ready to go, to adopt a certain role, and all this sort of stuff. And it seems like there's a relationship there, or there's a parallel there to the world of work. And so could some of the tenets of transformational leadership be used to help those guild leaders make their guild succeed and make players succeed in whatever it is they're trying to do within the game? And there's all kinds of potential benefits, both to the games and the players, to do this. And I think a related interesting question is, how do the game developers build and support effective MMO leaders or community leaders? Like, what tools and information and resources can they provide those guild leaders to help them be better transformational leaders or better leaders overall? And then another interesting really question, I think, is can player leaders, guild leaders, for example, be coached either by the game or some other automated system on how to be more effective leaders? You know, is there something that could be built into the game that would coach them and say like, okay, you should try doing this, or have you considered doing this, or have you practiced this skill in order to become a better leader? And the result would be, presumably, better guild leaders, better guilds, happier players. Number 16, how do social proof affect our perceptions of games? Social proof, the most basic concept or the most basic definition I can think of is that something is normal to the extent that we see other people doing it, right? So this goes back to the classic studies by Solomon Asch back in the 1950s, where he would bring like 12 people into a room and he'd say, okay, I'm going to show you two giant poster boards. And the one on the right has just a vertical line and the one on the left has three vertical lines. And your task is to tell me which of the ones on the left is the same length as the one on the right. It would usually be set up so that it was glaringly obvious which is the correct answer. But what would happen is that each one of the subjects in the room would say like, okay, it's line C, when line C was clearly the incorrect answer. And then it would finally come around to the last person in the group, and he or she would then have to decide like, do I want to believe the evidence in front of my eyes, or do I want to just go along with the group? And it turns out that they were the only real subject in the study. All the other people in the room were planted there by the experimenter to set up this concept of social proof, where they were saying something is true that's obviously not, so what would the person do? And they found that in a surprisingly large number of cases, that last person would say, like, yeah, line C is the one, even though that's totally not correct. We see this happen in more modern times with things like star ratings and download counts on songs and games. And I start to wonder about what are the roles of like influencers or, like YouTubers and Twitch streamers. How does this interact with their reputation through repeated interactions with an audience? Do people get savvy to it? How do they use things like Steam reviews, and can they be influenced by the social information that they get at? There's a lot that you could look at in the marketing and consumer psychology literature about this, but it would be fascinating to see it applied to some of the systems and platforms that we're all so familiar with, and to see like how the framing of that information affects what types of decisions you make as a player or as a consumer. Question number 17, how do gamers form perceptions of justice and fairness? Back in July of 2013, there was a game, perhaps you've heard of it, called Call of Duty Black Ops 2. And there was a patch issued for that game that very slightly tweaked some things like firing rate and other minute stuff like that for a particular gun that very slightly changed its effectiveness in the multiplayer game. And the design director for that game, as a result of that change, started receiving death threats, and worse via social media, just people completely flipping their lid and coming after him for making this change, saying, you nerfed this thing, it's totally unfair, you're out to get me, you hate me, and everything that you're doing is unfair and not well thought out. And that is perhaps an extreme example of a reaction, but I think the fact remains that people regularly do freak out to a lesser degree every time something in a game is changed. Every time a patch hits that changes some parameter, that changes some ability, cooldown timer, or damage percentage in a game, a lot of times people will look at that and say, that was unfair. You've nerfed my favorite class or my favorite weapon. So how do people form these perceptions and these judgments, and like what mediates that? There's a lot of research in the industrial organizational psychology literature, for example, that looks at how people form perceptions of fairness and justice in the workplace, whether it be like how rewards are distributed, a sort of distributive justice, or the procedures by which those decisions are made and the procedure by which things are distributed, or sort of procedural justice. And I think that game developers could learn a lot by looking at that literature and seeing how people have learned how to soften those blows and learned how to shape perceptions about fairness and, in fact, how to make more fair and more just decisions. Number 18, how does streaming affect how a game is played? So there's this concept called the audience effect, where if you are playing a game or doing an activity and you know that you have an audience, it can either help or hurt your performance. It can hurt your performance if you're doing a task that you think that is difficult for you. So if you're playing a game at a high difficulty, or you're playing something that you're not familiar with and you're having to learn and you're having to spend mental resources doing that, you don't have a lot of mental juice left over to deal with the fact that there's an audience there who may be judging you, and you're preoccupied with what they may be thinking, what you're doing, or keeping them entertained or looking good, and your performance on that task will suffer. Whereas if you're playing an easy game or a game that's easy for you, then you have the mental juice to spare, and so that doesn't happen. And in fact, knowing that you have an audience increases your motivation to do well at the game, so you may actually focus and try harder, and as a result, having an audience will help your performance. So what does this mean for people who stream games and play games on the internet? What do we know about the effects of having an audience there? Does that affect their performance in the same way? And then more interestingly, maybe, is what's the effect of having a virtual audience, or like a non-player character, an NPC within the game who's watching you, companions in your quest or whatever? Does that trigger the audience effect at all? That'd be a really interesting area for research. All right, lightning round number two, biases and heuristics. Because you see it's Lightning McQueen. Okay, so number 19, how do hot or cold emotional states or arousal affect our decision-making in games? Does the fact that we are mentally worked up put us in a position to be taken advantage of by certain sales pitches or design decisions? Number 20, does the history of an in-game object have an effect on how much we value it? So in games where you can trade items and sell items even to a vendor within the game, does the history that you have with a particular item or set of equipment or character, does that affect how much you value it? This goes back to what's called the endowment effect, where once people feel like they own an object, they will want more money to give it up than they would have spent to acquire it in the first place. Simply owning it increases its value. Number 21, how do sunk costs affect how we view and play games? So the idea is that you make a decision about whether or not to spend money or continue to spend money. You should really only make it on what you expect the future to be from that point forward, and not the money that you've sunk into it at that point. But that's not what we do. People fall prey to the sunk cost fallacy all the time. And one example of that might be when deciding whether or not to unsubscribe from an MMO or gaming service that you've paid a ton of money for, and you invested a lot in a character, and you don't want to lose that character and that progress that you've put into it, even though you're not having fun or you're not playing, you're never logging in. Number 22, how do our decision-making heuristics show up in games? Sort of a broad question, but there's a lot of information about how to, for example, frame risks in terms of losses or gains that could influence our decisions around how to do things like spend skill points or make narrative choices in games or buy equipment or gamble on blind boxes and in games, those types of things. Does the mirror exposure effect soften our reaction to the Wii U? Is that what happened there? The mirror exposure effect is the idea that even if something sounds really stupid or silly, like the Wii U, if we hear it repeated enough times and we're exposed to it enough times, it starts to sound normal and we start to get familiar with it and accept it more. So I'm wondering if that's what happened and that's why that console was named what it was. Okay, so let's talk about the next topic of competition. And again, similarly with social context, most games these days have some element of competition to them, whether it's comparing scores on a leaderboard, viewing each other's achievements, and so forth. There's something about the psychology of competition that's going to inform a lot of different games. And the next question is, how do leaderboards drive competition? Again, there seems to be the assumption that the inclusion of a leaderboard in a game is going to motivate players to keep trying and keep beating each other's scores, but what are the psychological mechanisms through which that works? Is it social comparison, where we kind of want to get information about our performance by comparing it to the performance of people similar to us and people that we're familiar with? And if so, how can information be best framed in that way to encourage competition and engagement? There's a lot that you could look at in social psychology and sports psychology around this type of stuff. Question number 25, how do group dynamics affect competition? How do various group dynamics change behaviors or attitudes in team-based or competitive games? There's a lot of different things that we know about a group that will affect the thoughts and the performance and the happiness of people within it. Things like group size and psychological safety, like whether or not people feel that they're safe to speak up and speak out. De-individuation, which is where you feel like you are less of an individual and more like a faceless part of a group. Group cohesion, what's called the frog pond effect, which is where you may be happier as the top member of a low performing group than you would be as the bottom member of a higher performing group. So how do these things affect what people think of a game when they're playing in a group? And how can game developers, again, structure, stack the deck, frame information such that players form happier conclusions and have happier reactions to their group experiences? There's a lot of stuff that you could draw here from the industrial organizational psychology, that is the psychology of the workplace stuff. Tons of research has been done on groups in that context, and I bet a lot of it would be great starting points for research on gaming in groups. Question number 26, what makes for a good artificial intelligence teammate or opponent? So it's not just how to code a really challenging opponent. I'm told that that's actually not that difficult to create a computer-controlled opponent that's really good at the game and really difficult to beat, especially for, you know, most non-grandmaster-type players. But the real challenge is to how to make an AI good so that it feels like playing against a human. And what are the effects of knowing that you're playing against a human or a computer? Does that change our motivation or frustration levels when we get beat or when we win, how satisfied we are with it? It's usually just a totally different game when we know that we're playing against a human opponent. But what are the types of things, like, why is that? And what could be borrowed from that to design a more interesting and a more satisfying computer-controlled opponent? Next topic is about different states of mind that we get in when we play games. Number 27, so what's up with immersion or spatial presence in games? Interestingly, the single most popular article on the whole Psychology of Games website is about immersion, or what psychologists usually call spatial presence, which is a term that's come up a lot more since virtual reality has become a thing. So this is the idea that you lose track of the technology that sits between you and the game world to the extent that you begin to feel like you are spatially present. Physically present in the game world. And it's a topic that's actually been studied a lot in other media as well. It's got kind of a long history where it's been studied about things like reading books and in movies and television and so forth. And that, though, is where the bulk of the research is on spatial presence. And there's not as much, there's getting to be more, but not as much about spatial presence in video games. So do we need models about spatial presence that are specific to games and virtual reality? Alternately, do we need to adjust the models given the nature of games? Things like interactivity and feedback and different types of technology. How games may interact with other types of presence like telepresence or social presence. And what systems, mechanics, and technologies increase the sense of spatial presence? And then is it all about the technology and how many P's of resolution you have or degrees of wraparound graphics? Or can things like the narrative and the artistic features of a game and the fact that things are interactive, things are drawing from genres and conventions that you are familiar with and for which you can fill in the blanks, does that have any effect on how easy it is for us to get into that state of mind? How do games create fear, horror, anger, joy, and other emotions? I actually get this question a lot as well, especially every October when Halloween starts to roll around and journalists are starting their psychology of fear in video games and psychology of horror games articles. But the question is always like, what triggers emotional responses in games? And I think it's an interesting question and one that I don't know that we've discovered the answer to. What psychophysiological loops can be hijacked to the player's benefit? So in other words, if you can affect things like their heart rate, then does that make them feel more tension and more fear just simply because their brains are looking for something to attribute that to? And then the related question of like what creates empathy for characters also fits in here. Does the concept of parasocial relationships apply to video games? Parasocial relationships comes from media psychology where we feel like we have an actual social relationship with a character in a television show, or maybe even like a real person on like a variety show or a talk show or a news program, for example, even though we know that like we can see what that person's doing and we can talk to them or think about them, but we know they're not thinking about us. But we still feel like we have some sort of relationship with them. Does that happen with fictional characters in games? Are there aspects of games that can facilitate those kinds of parasocial relationships? And what are the outcomes of those? Really interesting questions. And then finally, what is the dark side? Let's ask some questions about the dark side of psychology in video games. Number 29, why do people cheat in games? I get this question a lot. Does anybody here remember Mr. Rossetti, pictured here? This is the guy from Animal Crossing games who, if you turned your console off without saving your game properly, the next time you turned it on, Mr. Rossetti would pop up and he would royally chew you out for being a cheater. Because a lot of people would try to turn off the machine to get a better selection of random items from an in-game store or something like that. He didn't like that. He would call you a cheater. And the idea that calling you a cheater stung, because we don't like to be labeled that and we don't like to have that as part of our identity. And there's a lot of research around that to show that that's the way that you can curb cheating in other contexts, like academic cheating or cheating on the job and so forth. But there hasn't been as much or really hardly any research about cheating in video games. Like, what encourages or discourages it? Is it contagious? If you see other people doing it within a game, are you more likely to cheat as a result, as some of the research on academic cheating suggests? What can game designers and game developers and publishers do to reduce or mitigate cheating in games? What can they borrow from the integrity and conscientiousness research, for example, in personality psychology? And then finally, number 30, how do you reduce toxic behavior and harassment in games? This is another kind of pet question of mine, and it's one that I like to redirect people to whenever they start to complain about the effects of violent media. I say, well, that's getting a lot of study and that's a thing and that you can discuss, but I think the issue of toxic behavior and harassment in games is in a lot of ways worse because, you know, it's real and people do it and it has real effects on people. More so, I think, than simply viewing aggressive behavior or violent content. So what can be done to reduce toxic behavior and harassment in games? I think Riot Games, maker of League of Legends, has done some really fascinating work here, where they looked at different social cues and situations and stacked the social deck, so to speak, to be in the favor of greater sportsmanship and less harassment. They did some really interesting thing with the timing and the nature of punishments and rewards for bad and good behavior. And they looked at different traits that they could get people to self-select on when going into a game. And there's probably just a lot of other things that we could still borrow from social psychology to help combat harassment and help create environments in which harassment is not seen as acceptable or worth doing and which will get you punished. So those are the questions I have. If you have done any kind of this research or you played with it in your game design work, let me know how it goes. You can reach me at psychologygames.com. You can email me directly if you like at jamie@psychologygames.com. Or you can go to the website and find out how to contact me on various social media. Follow me on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, all that type of stuff. And you can reach out directly to me there on Twitter at Jamie Madigan. Thanks, and I hope you enjoyed it.